Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us, is what we say on this podcast.
It is indeed. And I'm Kimberly Adams. It's Tuesday, which means it's time to take a deep dive into a single topic. And today we are going to talk about corporate consolidation and how it's shaping our economy today.
And I guess maybe the way to think about this is sort of a continuation of some of the stuff that Molly and I did a number of years ago about whether capitalism is working the way it ought to. Mm-hmm. Because as companies consolidate, the companies generally win, but there are losers. And there are losers on the supply side. There are losers on the demand side. It's tricky to make sense of all this stuff, and that's what we're going to try to do today.
Yeah, I mean, and in the simplest of terms, consolidation, which, you know, we're going to get into the definitions of that later, it's been going on since the 80s in the way that we think about it today, which means that there are just fewer companies out there, period. Sometimes that's because one company bought out smaller ones, you know, eating them alive sometimes. Fewer different employers competing for workers, fewer companies out there competing with each other, whether it's to make, you know, your mustard or even deliver you your health care. So here to make us smart about this is Kate Bonn, who is the chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, which is a brand new title for you. Hey, Kate.
Hey. Thank you very much. Yeah, as of today.
Good deal.
So it's great. Good timing.
Yeah. So, okay, what do you make of our premise that consolidation is something that we should look at and that we need to understand if you want to understand why the economy works the way it does right now?
Yeah, I think that is a great premise. And I think Kai was very right that this calls into question the success of capitalism in organizing our economy. And one piece I would sort of want to add to that and keep in mind is that consolidation is a distinct phenomenon, but it intersects with other phenomenon that's going to help us explain some of these outcomes we see, particularly for workers, also for consumers. So consolidation as it intersects with other trends is really where we want to be looking at the detail here.
As regular people, not people who are in the news business of business in the economy, and certainly not economists who are you know, thinking about this stuff in very profound ways. But if I'm a consumer of news and there's a story about corporate consolidation, how do I best think of it other than, oh, companies are just getting bigger?
Sure. I mean, the way I would think about it, one really good example would be healthcare. I think we know that this is a pretty concentrated sector in the U.S. economy. For example, I'm from Eastern Massachusetts, where Partners Healthcare operates a huge majority of all the healthcare facilities in Eastern Massachusetts. And so that is sort of, that's consolidation. That is when there's hospital mergers. That is when there's maybe one big management company overarching a whole sort of sector in one location. But that's going to intersect with some other phenomenon. How many people live there? So how many people need access to healthcare? Is there good transportation? Is it easy to get around to a new job? Or if you're a consumer, find another health facility to get to? Who are the people who are going to be accessing that? So when I think of healthcare too, it's an industry that has a majority of women workers, particularly in some occupations like nursing. And so then we have to think of other factors, like women workers are much more likely to be primary caretakers in their families. And so that might constrain how they look for jobs too, if they know, you know, they're going to be the one getting a call from a school and having to go pick up a kid when they're sick. So maybe they can't commute 2 hours to work. And so that's sort of what I mean, is when you want to look at both concentration of the companies themselves, but also that sort of environment around where concentration is happening that helps us understand the ways in which companies are able to exercise their market power.
Okay, so let's get a little bit deeper into that example. Let's just take healthcare. When you're talking about consolidation and companies exercising their market power, what does that look like in terms of its impact on wages or even on the prices that consumers pay?
Sure. So research has found, when we look across all studies, that employers are facing what economists call low labor supply elasticity. It's not a very intuitive term, but it basically means pay sensitivity. Workers are not as pay sensitive as we would think they should be in an economy. And so, you know, if it's a perfectly competitive market, if your employer cuts your wages by 1 cent, you would quit and you'd go find another job. But that's not actually what's happening. So the research has found, for example, that if you cut wages by 5%, you're only going to lose maybe 10 to 20% of your workers. So you lose some, but not a lot. And ultimately, for an employer, when they're thinking about this, that might be worth it to them to lose 10% of their workforce if it means they get to keep more of that money in their profits.
Wait, can you back up for a second to that part? And I'm taking us a little bit off the rails here, where workers are not as price sensitive as pay sensitive as you might think. What?
Yeah. So workers are not responding to competition in the way we think they could. Wow. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One of them is that workers might not have perfect information. They might not know how much different jobs are paying. Mm-hmm. Employers might have better access to information on those kind of factors. Workers have really complicated preferences for the types of jobs they take. And preferences, I mean, as you know, talking to economists, is not totally a perfect term to describe this. It could be constraints. Again, if you're that secondary income earner in your family and a primary caretaker, maybe it's more of a constraint than a preference. And then the final one is just mobility costs. It is hard to move around between jobs. You know, you're not going to pick up and move to a new city within a week to find a better job. Mm-hmm. And so all these factors mean that workers just are not that pay sensitive in ways that we would predict in a perfectly competitive market.
Or even in a tight labor market, which we're supposedly in.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what we saw at the end of the last expansion. It was, you know, the longest expansion in, the American economy. But what happened was that the labor market still had a lot of slack. Even though we had had 10 years of employment growth, wages had not really been increasing. It took 10 years of expansion to finally get a little bit of pressure on wages, which I think is good evidence that, again, like employers have not had to compete for workers the way we think they would in a competitive economy. And they tend to take advantage of that by keeping wages pretty low.
Okay, so back to consolidation. So we know what it looks like sort of on the labor side. What about on the corporate side, right? Because, look, the corporate mantra is, you know, grow or die, right? I mean, Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta, said to me one time, if you're not getting bigger as a company, you're in slow motion liquidation.
Well, there's two ways that concentration or sort of like the growth of a company can impact what a company is doing. Sometimes it does make a company more efficient. That, you know, certainly can be the case when there's economies of scale. So maybe it's just, you know, easier to produce more. Mm-hmm. But it also seems that, you know, that's not necessarily what's been happening in the past 20 years or so in the U.S. economy, that companies are growing, but not because they're becoming more efficient. Rather, they're just doing what is called rent seeking. So they're sort of making outsized profits, markups above and beyond the value of what they're creating. So, you know, it's hard to do that research and dig in to delineate between efficiency and rent seeking. Mm-hmm. But it does seem, you know, evidence does seem to suggest that the growth we're seeing now is not because of efficiency gains to the economy.
They just have a lot of money and so they're buying everything. Right.
Yeah. And I think we see some of that now too. I mean, most recently we see a lot of reports about trying to make sense of the direction of prices right now. And this is happening in particular sectors in the economy. Meanwhile, we see, you know, corporate earning calls talking about runaway profits. And so I think we do see a little bit of that. Because it's important to keep in mind in our like classic textbook economic models, companies shouldn't make any profit or really a minimal profit. So when you see huge profits, that is evidence that there is a corporate power problem.
All right, wait, hold on. Man, I'm taking this thing sideways like 19 different ways. Companies aren't supposed to make profits?
Not in a traditional model. There should be zero profits because it should be competed away. If there are profits, other companies would open up in that sector and compete with them. Oh. And then profits should compete down to zero until it's an efficient market. So that might be part of it too, is there's just big barriers to entry. I think some sectors, you see that particular like airline industry, I think is a good classic example of big barriers to entry. It's hard to start your own airline. So they take advantage of that and they're able to mark up prices.
Right. Okay. That's wild. I've been doing this a long time. I've never heard that. That's fascinating. But then again, I never took an econ course, so that's a whole different thing.
Abstract economic models are sort of useful tools, and it is sometimes important to remember that they do not reflect real life.
Right.
Okay. So then again, circling back to consolidation.
Sorry.
No, it's interesting. That was fascinating. What, if anything, should be done about consolidation? I mean, is this something where the U.S. government needs to step in? If so, does the government have any tools to step in?
Oh, for sure. I would say I put it sort of in two broad categories. One category is competition policy, and so that includes things like antitrust enforcement done by the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, but not only, because there's other federal agencies that do influence competition, like the Federal Communications Commission could also try to foster competition in communications, for example, which is not a dig at you all as media personalities. But that is one side, is to try to, so that's one side, is to focus on antitrust enforcement, make sure that we are reviewing mergers to make sure that they are pro-competition, make sure we are going after anti-competitive behavior on the part of companies with things like perhaps maybe a non-compete agreement for a worker, where an employer says that they sign and say they will not go for work for another employer. So that's one bucket. The second bucket is also just what I sort of call countervailing power, which is, you know, as you noted, sometimes big companies, our growth is good, and sometimes big companies can lead to sort of efficiency gains. But what we need is power on the opposite side of work for workers and consumers to make sure that we are balancing that they can't, you know, raise profits too high above and beyond what is reasonable. That workers are able to share in the value that they help create. And so that would be through things like making sure workers can unionize, increasing statutory minimum wages, making sure that employers aren't engaging in wage theft. Things like that I would put on the sort of the countervailing power side.
Sorry, can I just be the realist jerk here for a second and ask you what you evaluate the odds of any of that happening being?
I think there's some evidence that maybe we can move forward on a couple things. Like, for example, the wage theft argument. The Department of Labor is looking into ways to address wage theft. The National Labor Relations Board is looking into ways to make sure that we have deterrence for unfair labor practices that would illegally prevent workers from unionizing. So there's a little bit of work that can be done, particularly on the enforcement side and the executive action side. But if we really want sort of massive structural change, you're right that something like reforming labor law or reforming consumer protections through our legislative process is not probably going to happen anytime soon. But the fact that, you know, more people are paying attention to consolidation as an issue means maybe we're part of the long-term arc toward making sure our economy is more competitive.
Kate Bond, she is the Director of Labor Market Policy, also Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Kate, thanks a lot. Really totally interesting stuff.
Thanks, Kate.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon. That was great. That was good. And I learned just like a whole slew of stuff, too, other than
what
the
subject was. I was about to say, my brain broke a little bit.
I know. Corporate profits aren't supposed to exist? What? That's so fascinating.
But it's logical.
I know. It should be competed away. Totally, totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. But holy cow.
Man, so I'm going to have to sit with that one for a while.
No joke. All y'all sit with it, too. Let us know what you think about what Kate said or any of those random sidebars that I inserted into that interview. And let us know what you think. Our number is 508-827-6278, 508-UB-SMART.
Or you can send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will be right back once we finish head exploding. Okay, time for the news fix. I'm going to start because I have not that one yet. I was
going to get to that later. That's a good one. We should save that for the end.
We're going to save that for the end. No, mine is a Ukraine story. And I know we're doing this every day, but this is something that's been sort of percolating in the back of my head, mind, brain, whatever, throughout this, as we talk about the different long-term economic impacts of the global disruption to supply chains, particularly around food supplies. And we've mentioned before that Ukraine and Russia are big exporters of grains and wheat and corn and all these things. And those are cut off. For the most part, Ukraine has banned the export of wheat and other vital food commodities. And Russia is obviously under all these sanctions, and these are big suppliers of a lot of countries in the developing world, to the point that the UN International Fund for Agricultural Development said that they are worried about conflict and hunger in other parts of the world as a result of this. And now the Pentagon is apparently having a look at this and just kind of keeping an eye on things and where these disruptions to global food supplies might potentially trigger additional rounds of conflict. Mm-hmm. And this is a real thing. And so a government executive has a good piece on this, which gets into this quite a bit. And some of the places they're worried about instability, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, mm-hmm, Iran, mm-hmm, places that really rely on those exports. And, you know, it's not like we don't have relatively recent history of spikes in food prices triggering unrest in that part of the world. And so, you know, it's just worth keeping an eye on that part of it.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, we've done a couple of interviews on Marketplace about this, and it's war and food hunger go together. Mm-hmm. Hunger go together. And this one's going to exacerbate it more than most because of the role that Ukraine and Russia play in global food supplies. And it's really bad. It's really bad. Food, yeah, and edible oils. Okay. Mine is a little more dorky, but that's okay. And it comes with the observation that tomorrow, which will be Wednesday, I don't know when all y'all are going to listen to this, the Federal Reserve and Chair Pro Tempore Jay Powell will raise interest rates probably 25 basis points, a quarter of one percentage point. And that will be big news because inflation and the Fed and all of that stuff. But I do want to point out that the Fed is not playing with a full deck, as it were. And I say that not pejoratively. There are three vacancies on the 7-member board of the Fed. And as the Fed tries to handle this economy and inflation and post-pandemic and a war, it would be great if they had all seven people because it's a full-time job figuring out what to do with this economy. And I mention this because Senate Republicans and one Democrat are blocking one of President Biden's nominees, Sarah Bloom Raskin. She's a noted economist. She teaches at Duke. She's been on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors once previously in 2010, confirmed by the Senate. She's been Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, also confirmed by the Senate. And now she is going to, in my humble opinion, have to withdraw because of the opposition of Senate Republicans and Joe Manchin on the Democratic side. And that's kind of too bad. And I just it needs to be noted that I don't get it. I don't understand how you can be confirmed twice. And then just because you think the Federal Reserve ought to do something about climate change, you're somehow not acceptable to a senator from a coal producing state. Oh, wait, I just figured it out. Sorry. I just figured it out.
Additional clarity. Sarah Bloom Raskin has written in the past, yeah, and spoken in the past on the importance she believes in integrating the effects of climate change into economic planning,
right,
and long-term decisions by the Federal Reserve. And the West Virginia coal-producing state senator is Joe Manchin, yeah, in this context.
We should say Susan Collins from Maine has come out against her. We should say Lisa Murkowski from the oil-producing state of Alaska has come out against Bloom Raskin. So this one's pretty much done. And she's, you know, 9.5 chances out of 10, she's going to have to withdraw to let the White House save face and move on. But it's quite something. Quite something.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. All right. One entity that is not going to be able to save face.
You go. That was a good pivot. You come up with a pivot, you get to do the item. Go ahead.
The same company that had the ship stuck in the Suez Canal now has a huge cargo ship stuck in the Chesapeake Bay.
It's too funny. It's too funny. The other one was called the Ever Given. This is the Ever Forward. And it is not blocking the Chesapeake Bay because, thankfully, the Chesapeake Bay.
Either.
Yes, it's not moving forward. Chesapeake Bay is wider than the Suez Canal. But come on. How do you do that? Get stuck twice in a year.
It ran aground, it seems. It's not going to gum up global shipping in the same way. But the irony is a lot.
It's just, it's a lot. It's kind of rich. Yeah, it's kind of lovely. All right.
Okay, that's it for the news fix. Let's go ahead and do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
New sting there, courtesy of Drew Jostad, I do believe. Which I kind of like, kind of peppy, kind of upbeat.
It's fun.
Here's the deal. A lot of you are really happy that Ms. Adams is going to be making us all smarter every single day. And some of you, which I mean a lot, send in voice messages. So here we go.
Hi, Make Me Smart team, Kimberly and Kai.
Kimberly's awesome.
I have loved every episode that you've filled in for.
And I was just going to say, she should be the next co-host.
I love the perspective and humor and cocktails that Kimberly brings to the show, and I am so looking forward to more Make Me Smart.
On Thursday, Kai laying out all that love for Kimberly and saying how great she is, and then News Adams just sneaking in with a frickin' sucker punch about Never Ending Story. Excellent. A+. 100%. Please.
That was Mary out of Hendersonville, North Carolina. Emily's from Watertown, Massachusetts. Lauren out of Oakland, and Beth from New York. Yeah. Well, it's going to be one of those runs for me on this podcast. Is it? Fine. Yeah, it was good stuff. Good stuff.
It was fun. Okay. Thank you all for that. That's really sweet. It makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. I appreciate it. Okay, but before I get full awkward, here is today's answer to the Make Me Smart question, pandemic edition, which we asked you to tell us what is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about, specifically about the pandemic.
Hi, this is Ian from Boston, Massachusetts. A thing I thought I knew before the pandemic and found out I was wrong about was that I was an introvert. I'm not an introvert. I should have known better. The pandemic made that very, very clear.
That's kind of deep, actually, but yeah, I get that.
I have to say, I think the pandemic kind of reinforced the fact that I was an introvert because I saw my extroverted friends.
Shut up! You are not an introvert. Shut up! I'm an introvert. There's no chance you're an introvert. Get out of here. We're gonna have to do a Myers-Briggs on this show. That's ridiculous. Seriously?
Yeah.
I refuse to believe that.
Okay. That doesn't make it any less true.
Well, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But wow, I did not have that down on any personality thoughts that I had about you, which granted were just, you know, professional. But wow, that's interesting.
No, I mean, like all my friends who are extroverts, they're like, we must meet up. Let's go for a walk. Let's do this. And I'm like, I will stay in my house.
Really? Really?
But, you know, I had the privilege of being able to do that. Not everybody did. And,
yeah,
you know,
fair enough.
Having a safe home and all the perks of being who I am made that possible. But, yeah, I had some other friends who were just like, must escape.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. So if you've got more, two things. Number one, the straight up Make Me Smart question. Which we'll always take your answers on, but also what you thought you knew from this pandemic and later found out you were wrong about. Let us know. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Leave us a message at 508-827-6278 if you like. 508-UBSMART.
I guess something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about was an extrovert.
That's too funny.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Marque Green and Ellen Rolfes, who writes our newsletter. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program is engineered by Jake Cherry. Drew Jostad's going to mix it down later. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bonner. Ben Tolliday, update, by the way. He's going on vacation soon. Asked me about my thoughts on him flying on a 787 Max. I said, or 737 Max. I said, I thought it'd be all right. Senior producer is Bridget Bonner. Donna Tam is director of On Demand. Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. And there we go.
I feel like we've talked about this introvert thing before.
I don't think so. But maybe I'm wrong.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.